From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Well, thank you for saying your prayers for our dear friend Bill Handel from KFI, our station and affiliate here in Los Angeles. He had open heart surgery Friday morning. He's doing okay. He's on the mend. He'll be back. Here's what's happening. It's just a race against time in Japan as they try to contain the nuclear fallout, the radiation there. And here at home, California air quality officials are saying they saw no elevated radiation levels yet on U.S. West Coast areas from Japan's nuclear power plant disaster. Radiation levels have not shown an increase at any of the monitoring stations up and down the West Coast so far. And ever wonder what the fourth largest earthquake since 1900 sounds like? The Laboratory of Applied Bioacoustics has posted the eerie sound online. The Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology, which is a network of underground observations more than 1,000 meters below sea level, made the chilling recording as the quake struck. Would you like to be in the middle of all of that? Thanks to a fluke of orbital mechanics that brings the moon closer to Earth than it has been in more than 18 years, the biggest full moon of 2011 will occur on Saturday, leading some observers to dub it as the supermoon. Geologist Jim Berklin on the line with us here. Jim, what do you think?
Well, the supermoon designation is about right. I've been calling it the syzygy perigee date, and it's very similar to what happened just before the World Series quake, in which on October 14th of 1989, we had the full moon and the closest approach to the moon in 3 years, just 4 hours apart. Well, tomorrow, the full moon and the closest approach to the moon for the next 6 years will be less than 1 hour apart, and they will be within 1 day of the vernal equinox with this equinoctial tide. So that's why we're having extremely high tidal effects, and it got me a little concerned, more than as much as concerned as I was before the World Series quake. Ooh. The main difference is there are far fewer animal reports than we had before, but at least in Southern California, we know that that strange fish was found on Malibu Beach, called the earthquake
and
fish.
And dolphins and whales.
And the sperm whales, the whole pod of sperm whales were seen by a cruise ship off San Diego, and they were delighted because they had never seen sperm whales that close to shore before. And then you had all those dead fish there at the Redondo Beach and down at Acapulco. There was a dense school of fish right next to the beach, and they weren't dying as far as I know, but the people were going out with the nets and buckets and getting dinner. It was pretty easy. So let's see, we had that. And also at the zoo in San Diego, a zookeeper was bitten by a panda, and that's the first time for the mild little pandas to be all disturbed. Huh. And according to one of the reporters down there, there's a record number of missing pets. Instead of about 70 total at the animal shelter, it was like 140.
That's interesting. Okay, Jimmy. So right now on this program, make a prediction. What's going on?
Well, we have several. One is a 4 to 5 magnitude quake in the Bay Area, and a 5 to 6 magnitude quake in Southern California, a 4 to 6 in Washington or Oregon, and a 7 magnitude plus in the Ring of Fire. And I made it back in 1989. I said they expect a Ring of Fire quake of at least 7 between the 14th and 21st of October.
So all within the next few days, you're saying?
Yeah, this is the window from the 19th to the 26th. And in April, it won't be much better in terms of earthquake potential. So, and then it's going to be fairly quiet till September from my calculations. But meanwhile, this is an extremely potent seismic window, a very clear window, and And I'll be quite surprised if these quakes don't pan out.
Jim, can we blame the Japanese earthquake, which occurred a week ago, can we blame that on the upcoming supermoon?
No. Well, some of the scientists said there's no way. But that quake did occur between two full moons and close perigees. And so a lot of times you can have the maximum tidal stress, and it's not accompanied by the big quake. The quake itself has to wait a week or two for the things to settle down. Like you can have you bend the pencil between your fingers and you hear the crackling sounds.
Sure.
And suddenly it doesn't fail. I mean, you don't continue to make it rupture. You just ease off on the pen, continue to write with it. But then if you come in a little while later and bend it until it goes past the strength of the material, then you get another quake. Even though the causative force was not as great as it was when you had the maximum tides go to the secondary period. So the secondary window this month, was on the right after the new moon, 5 days after the new moon of the 4th.
Okay, so here we are, right here, Jim Berklin, our geologist, making a prediction that over the next couple days, there could be earthquakes in Southern California, and there could be a major one again in the Ring of Fire. So let's see what happens. Jim, thank you so much. I have a feeling we're calling you back next week. His website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. You know, for the very first time, Earth has a regular orbiting eye in the sky spying on the solar system's smallest and strangest planet, Mercury. NASA's spacecraft called MESSENGER successfully veered into a pinpoint orbit after 6.5 years of a trip and 4.9 billion miles in tricky maneuvering to fend off the gravitational pull of the sun. It is the fifth planet in our solar system that NASA has orbited in addition to the Earth and the Moon. Who other than our science advisor and head of the Enterprise Mission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, back from his Mayan cruise? Here you are, safe and sound. So did you feel any bump at all from the tsunami when you were calling into the show?
Not during, it takes hours and hours and hours at jet plane speeds, but in the middle of the dawn, in the morning, we did feel and see a change in the interaction of the waves with the wake of the ship. And I was up on the top deck with, about 100 people doing the star sighting, including with Ed Grimley's amazing night vision technology.
Yeah, he's good.
And we suddenly heard this change. We all looked at each other, and it was very distinct. It may have been just a surface transient effect off the coast of Mexico, but the safest place to be in a tsunami is on a 100,000-ton ship.
That's right.
And the captain told me on the bridge the following day when we went up there, he said there actually had been a passenger in the elevator who looked at him very seriously and said, "Are we going to die?"
Jeez.
And that disturbed me because with all the information we have available, including what's going on in Japan now, if people can't reach a reasoned conclusion about the probability of worst-case scenarios or what's going to happen to them, I mean, we are awash in information, George. You, the Internet, all the networks, everybody's up to their eyebrows in information. So that question to the captain, I thought, was very disturbing because it meant that that individual had no idea as to the physics of what was being involved, and he was basically extremely serious.
Well, there's no doubt, as you said when you called in, by the way, $146 phone call, Richard, but no doubt that the safest place to be during a tsunami is out to sea on a big ship.
Absolutely. Do you know that they are building what they call world ships somewhere in, I think, South America, maybe in Argentina? There's a project which has been going on for years, two major corporations building huge thousands of foot long vessels, and no one quite understands why they're doing it. And I'm thinking in directions of 2012. I mean,
floating cities.
Yeah, they're floating cities. Some of them I've looked at, they're projected to be a mile long. If you wanted to save human beings during the potential catastrophe of 2012, that would be the one place you would be absolutely safe on a ship like that in the middle of the ocean.
Richard, a trip to Mercury, MESSENGER, 6.5 years?
Yep.
I thought it was really close.
Well, it's relatively close, but remember, it's the closest planet to the sun. It whips around it in 50-some days.
Ah.
And you can't get there from here by driving in a straight line because we don't have the rocket fuel.
You got to go in circles to catch it.
What they did is they used interplanetary billiard ball techniques, meaning they launched this thing into orbit around the sun. They then did a burn that would take it past Venus, which subtracted energy so it could fall closer to the sun. They passed by Venus and Mercury three times around that sun in flyby before they had lost enough energy subtracted by the interaction with the gravitational fields of those planets so they could then use the onboard engine and burn into a very elliptical orbit, which they did just a little over 24 hours ago, and we are going to get the most astonishing data on the most mysterious planet in the inner solar system. I mean, we know almost nothing about Mercury, except it's not like any other place we have ever visited.
They have said that temperatures there swing so wildly, 1,100 degrees, in some areas down to minus degrees because of the shadows. How can that be when you're so close to the sun?
You're obviously reading the New York Times. Well, it's because...
No, I'm reading your website.
Okay. Because it rotates almost synchronously, like the moon, which has one side facing the Earth all the time.
Yeah.
And the other side facing away. Well, Mercury doesn't do that. It has what's called a two-thirds synchronous orbit, meaning it spins once around for every... two-thirds of the way around for every orbit of the sun. So eventually, all sides see the sun. And on the sun side, the temperature zooms up to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. But on the night side, at any one moment, the temperature can be 300 below zero.
That's amazing.
Because there's no atmosphere, essentially. There's a wispy trace of a hydrogen atmosphere, which is kind of stolen from the sun's corona, but it really doesn't hang around. So we're going to learn amazing things. And in the next several weeks, couple, 3 weeks, we're going to get our first orbital pictures. But there's spectral data, there's magnetometer data, there's data on the core.
Well, I want to get your analysis, at least.
The core of Mercury is 60% bigger than the Earth in terms of size, and it's twice the mass.
That's amazing. All by itself. Hey, what's coming up for you? Speaking engagements.
Robin and I are going to Europe again.
Again?
In a couple weeks. Well, we've been there before.
We're going to
go back.
All right.
I spoke in England a couple of years ago. We're now going to go to Amsterdam for the first time. I'm looking forward to it. Of course, sleeping at night under the sea is not exactly what I like to do. But
I hear you got bitten by a spider.
Before we left for the cruise, yeah. Actually, it may have been a scorpion. We don't know.
You okay?
And I'm fine. Okay. Anyway, in Amsterdam, I'm going to be talking to the Secret Space Program Conference. And if people in Europe want to know how to see this, all they do is log on to the Internet to www.secretspaceprogram.com, and that will give you the venues, the speakers. I'm on with Richard Dolan, Timothy Good.
Classic people.
Great people, great people.
Right. One last thing, by the way.
Yeah?
If I say this word to you, tell me what language I'm speaking. You ready?
Okay.
Nyet.
Yet?
Nyet.
Oh, Nyet, Russian.
That's right. I understand Russians have been visiting you.
We had a Russian camera
crew. I've got
crew.
Spies watching you.
Yeah, you have good sources. We had a Russian camera crew come here yesterday, again, all the way from Russia. They're doing a documentary, an hour-long documentary, apparently to air in the first week of April, just before the 50th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's orbital flight. And they pressed me on all kinds of things about the structures on the moon, on Mars, you know, Phobos, the rings of Saturn, everything you ever wanted to know about our work. And they even interviewed Robin. They even interviewed Morala.
The dog.
They took pictures of us in the backyard with Morala.
That's
and,
funny.
You know, the mountains and all that. Anyway, it's going to air in 2 or 3 weeks. And the key question they wanted answered was, why is President Obama not going back to the moon when everybody else on the planet is? And I gave them some pretty good insights into what I think is going on.
That's a great question. Richard C., thank you so much. EnterpriseMission.com. Up next, a true account of the San Pedro haunting. Get ready. It's Friday on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. He's a producer, cameraman, writer, Barry Conrad. Has always been intrigued by the unusual, the paranormal, especially ghost stories. He has investigated more than 150 cases in the past 22 years And it wasn't until his experience as one of the chief investigators of the San Pedro haunting that Barry decided to devote his energies to documenting, on film, evidence of an alternate reality which points to the existence of a spiritual realm. Here he is back. It's been a while on Coast to Coast. Barry, how are you?
Oh, good, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good. Always good to talk with you. It's been too long, though.
I know. It's been several years, I think, but always enjoyed remembering back to that show and listening to your show pretty regularly.
Well, here. I know you're out there. We keep tabs on you.
I'm still here, still doing my thing, that's for sure.
What's new with you?
Well, actually, my editor, Stephen Robin, and I right now are editing a couple of new pilots that I'm producing. One's on UFOs, and it's called Case Files UFO, and the other's Case Files Unknown, which is kind of all of the paranormal. And the UFO thing that I'm doing is getting into some of the more unusual things with people with footage. And I've recently uncovered some unknown footage taken of the Phoenix Lights just recently, just the last few years, by a fellow by name Dave Williams lives up in Northern California. And so we're going to incorporate that. This footage has never been seen before. In some ways, it's even clearer than some of the video shot, in 1997 of the Phoenix Lights.
Wow. So this is 13, 14 years old. Where's he been?
I don't know. I don't know. But he moved there about 5 years ago, I believe it was. And he was intrigued by it, and he always kept his camera handy. And South Mountain, there was a lot of these things up here. And one night they saw this little dance going on, these strange triangular-shaped lights, and he had his video camera handy and got it on camera.
Barry, what got you interested in ghosts?
Boy, George, goes back a long way. I'm originally from a little town called Hamilton, Ohio, and my mother had a friend who had a ghost in her house, and furniture would move, and people would feel like they were being asphyxiated, when there was no smoke, and found out that, when they did a research on the house, that someone had died in the house 100 years before from a fire. So the house had been rebuilt. So I was intrigued that this woman was not the type to make up a story like that. And there was an old abandoned farmhouse around the corner from the road where I grew up in Fairfield, actually. It's called right near Hamilton, Ohio. And it was just looked like the typical gothic old farmhouse, and my cousin Dale and I went up there right at dusk, and we were looking through the window, and I thought I saw, like both of us thought we saw, kind of a lady in white, shimmering, kind of white, wearing a long white dress, floating down the staircase. But it was so quick, I never knew for sure, whether or not it was a ghost or not. So I was pretty young, I was about 9 or 10, something like that at that time. But it intrigued me a lot, George. And then, I started paying attention to some of the shows that were going on mm-hmm. at that time. And, there was a series. And I don't know if your readers, your listeners, rather, would remember the series. But it just recently got released on DVD. Do you remember the show Thriller?
Oh, sure.
Boris Karloff.
Yep.
Well, they did, I think, some of the darkest and most intriguing ghost stories. And I started watching those shows, and I got even more intrigued. I remember one with William Shatner called The Hungry Glass, and it was so spooky and so scary. It was about a couple that move into this old haunted house in New England, and the ghosts live or reside within the mirrors of the house. They find all these mirrors in the attic of the house, and a woman had died there years ago from broken glass and things, from shattered mirrors, and these ghosts became killers. They actually tried to suck people into the mirrors. So things like that, I think, really intrigued me. And it wasn't until 1989, though, that I really ran into the real McCoy, for sure.
Good for you. Barry, we're going to talk when we come back after the break about the San Pedro haunting in California. This one's unusual, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. I had worked with Dr. Barry Taff on a few cases. Nothing really major happened. He's the one that did the Entity story that became that movie with Barbara Hershey years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to, we were a couple things. We were on the Queen Mary, and that is extremely haunted, although I never saw anything there.
It's strange.
Oh, yes.
It's a strange ship.
It sure is. There's a lot of things that have happened there. It has a long history. And he got a call, actually, from a lady named Susan Castaneda. Unfortunately, Susan just passed away just recently. She was sort of the catalyst for all of this. And she said she had a girlfriend named Jackie Hernandez,
that was living in this little bungalow in San Pedro, California, which is a little south here of L.A. And she said that there was a lot of things going on that she had witnessed.
Let's get into that when we come back. We're going to talk about the unknown encounter, a true account of the San Pedro haunting. You know, every once in a while here in the Los Angeles area, I'll go to a restaurant called the Great Greek. Super people there, by the way. And the manager, his name's Dionites, and he was telling me yesterday, he said, George, can you believe the past decade we had January 1st, 2001. Then we had 222, 333, 444, 555, all the way up to 10, 10, 10. And then he said, in this decade, this year, we're going to have November 11th, 2011, 11, 11, 11. And then in December of next year, we're going to have 12, 12, 12. But he said, the scary part, George, is what happens with number 13. And I said, what do you mean, Dave? He said, can you imagine 13, 13, 13? That's not good. And I said, well, don't worry about it. He said, what do you mean don't worry about it? I said, it's not going to happen. He said, yes, it's going to happen. It's going to be a disaster. I said, D, go get a calendar. So he did. And I said, now count them. Count the months. And he did. And he looked at me and said, where's number 13? And welcome back to Coast, Barry Conrad, our guest. Barry, tell me, how did you become involved in the investigation of this San Pedro haunting? And tell us about the haunting.
Well, as I mentioned, Dr. Taft, who did the entity, he got the call from a lady named Susan Castaneda, who was a friend of this woman, Jackie Hernandez, who lived in a small bungalow in San Pedro. And she said that there was a ghost in the house. Her friend was having problems in a big way with all of this because she had witnessed a lamp fly off a table. So she had seen some things. So we went down there on August 8th, 89. And boy, that's, I tell you, that's a date that will live in my memory forever, among many others to follow. But we went down there, and I had a gentleman working for me at that time, a good friend of mine named Jeff Wheatcraft, who was a total skeptic debunker type. I mean, not that he was going around, you know, debunking hauntings for anything like that or wanted to, but he just was not a believer. And he said, if I ever, you know, had this experience, I'm sure I could explain it way rationally, you know. So he was with me. And Taft was there, and there was a small group of women that were friends of Jackie. And we met with Jackie. She was a very simple, you know, pleasant woman. And what impressed me, George, was the fact that the women, when we first got there, when they started telling us these stories, they were scared. They were frightened. You could just tell.
You could see it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they started telling these crazy stories. Well, Jackie told us that she would hear noises in her attic, scratchings and bangings and all that kind of stuff. But what was really scary and spooky was the fact that she not only heard these strange noises, but she said that in the children's bunk, they had two bunk beds, in the children's bedroom, rather, she'd see this old, decaying-like old man that was wearing a red flannel shirt and was sitting cross-legged on the lower bunk. He was, he was there for a few seconds. He would disappear, and he would just stare at her. But it was very corpse-like, very, very scary. And to add to that, she told us about she had one day checked out her attic. She went up to, up to the crawl space. There was this crawl space which existed above the laundry room. She had a little laundry room in the
old houses had that.
Yeah, they do. And so she would, she went up there, a friend of hers found some money or something. She said, well, maybe I'll find some money in my attic. And she got on top of the washing machine, and so her, upper torso was kind of suspended into the crawl space opening, and she saw a disembodied head floating towards her.
Jeez.
Different than the old man, George. Very different than the old man. She said it was very kind of, had jowls, kind of corpulent features, rather looked like a heavy-set man's head would look like. So we heard the stories, and Jeff whispered to me, he said, boy, it's going to take a lot for me to believe this yarn, He's very skeptical. And so, to be honest with you, I mean, I didn't feel anything when I first went in that house. It was quiet. I was very, impressed by the apparent sincerity of these women because they were all describing unexplainable events. So before we left, I hadn't even brought in my video camera, which is unlike me, but I've been on a lot of other cases and nothing, you know, ever happened. So this is...
You never know, Barry.
You never know. I do take one now with me everywhere.
Yeah.
And I asked Jeff if he wanted to take a few pictures in the attic before we left. And I remember we kind of, you know, we toured the back part of the house. And as we were walking through the back bathroom area leading, on the other side was the door led into the laundry room. We smelled iodine in the house, just overpowering sensation of iodine. And then it just dissipated as quickly as it arrived. And then I felt sort of a tingling in my head, sort of a overpressure feeling that you would get if you were underwater several fathoms, something like that. But I never really paid much attention to that, really. I mean, I felt it, but it really, you know, didn't really register with me at first. And then Jeff went up, and he was taking a few pictures, but he didn't go all the way up into the attic. He was standing on top of that washing machine that Jackie had stood on. He was a tall guy. He's about 6'3". And so he put like a milk crate on top of the washing machine. So again, it was just his upper torso suspended into this, you know, dark crawl space.
Sure.
So he took a few pictures and he came back down and he turned to me and he said, well, I didn't see anything. He says, but it's funny. I feel like there's something watching me from behind. And there was another guy named Larry Brooks there that night. He was a friend of Taft's. And Larry kind of facetiously said, well, hey, why don't you go back up there and take a few pictures over your shoulder, thinking, well, maybe you'll capture the ghost itself. So Jeff sort of, you know, laughed at that, and he went back up, and he took a few pictures. He was into the third frame. He was taking, squeezing off the third picture with his Canon 35-millimeter camera. And suddenly we all hear a scream or a shout. And he comes bolting down from that crawl space, and he's shaking like a leaf. All the color had drained out of him. I've never seen him like that before. And, of course, we all crowded around him as he came down, and we said, what happened? You know, what happened, Jeff? And Jeff said, something just pulled the camera out of my hands.
And this guy was a skeptic, wasn't he?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Very much skeptical, very agnostic when it comes to anything spiritual or even religious. You know, he didn't believe in any of this stuff. And so he was, you know, getting a reality check here. And so, you know, I said, well, gosh, I want to go back up and see what happened. Let me go get my video equipment. And I did. I went and got the video equipment. And if you remember the old days, we had the 3/4-inch decks and you had the...
Oh, everything was heavy.
Oh, because I know you worked in television too, George.
Oh, sure.
Those were not easy days for a camera guy.
Tell me, Barry, about the bathtub incident.
Well, yeah, there was another night in that house where Jackie was taking a bath in that back bathroom on the lower floor there, on the ground floor of the house. And she said that there were balls of light that started appearing under the water and started spinning around her, rotating around her body. Now, they never harmed her. Nothing like that happened. But they were actually spinning under the water. So, you know, you think if it was a normal light that would have an electrical charge to it, that she would have been electrocuted or something. But no, nothing like that happened, thank God. And so that was another thing that happened.
What do you think's going on out there?
Well, I don't know, but it was an old house. It was built 1905 because later on I did went back and did a research on the history of the house. It was very close to the harbor out there. It was very close to the ocean. You know, they say that water, you know, is a powerful resource, generates energy. Of course, the whole world started with water, so that would make sense. They say ghosts are attracted to water. Why that house, I really don't know, but there was something too about Jackie, I think, that whatever this thing was, it seemed to latch on to her energy.
Did anything ever happen in that house a long time ago?
Well, we never knew for sure because I did a lot of research, never could find evidence of, any kind of a violent act. But there was later on we had this amazing Ouija board thing, which happened after the lady moved.
What happened?
Well, we were up in Weldon.
I don't like Ouija boards.
We normally don't use them, but this lady had given her a Ouija board after she moved out of the house. And it told us that, it's murderer had lived in the house So it's possible that the ghost was haunting the house. It was attached because of the killer being there. And also, Jeff had the likeness of his killer. But George, going back to the original house before she even moved out of here, I think this is what makes this case extremely unique and scary, is that on September 4th, we went back down there, just Jeff and another friend of mine, Gary Bame, who was from Ohio, who was living here at the time. And he was also pretty skeptical. And they went up into the attic because Jackie had called me and said that this ghost had held her down on the floor. And she was watching television with her children, and she couldn't breathe. And if it wasn't for the will to live for her children, she wouldn't have made it. But she was able to break free of this force, you know, this powerful force that held her down. So that's why we went down there, and we have the, you know, the phone calls and everything recorded on the answering machine. And we get down there, and it's very quiet. Jackie's out on the front porch with her children. She got them out of the house. Her friend Susan came over and had described hearing noises and so forth in the attic. But it was very quiet. And when Jeff and Gary decided to check out the attic again, I decided to stay down because I didn't want to hurt my camera. I was afraid I'd lose my camera.
Protect that camera.
Yeah. I was afraid I'd never get my camera back. And that was like maybe at that time, maybe a $30,000 camera, you know. And they went up there, and I was standing talking to the two ladies in this little dimly lit laundry room down below the attic. And there was a period of time, like 20 minutes or so went by before anything happened, and I suddenly saw a light. It was an orangey-red light that just shot in front of me and the two ladies and disappeared, an orb of light, if you will. And then we all three heard three snapping sounds, just like someone, you know, snapping their fingers three times. And I got this overpowering sensation of being watched to my left, and that was the open bathroom. And I turned on the camera. I started rolling footage. As soon as I did, we hear a groan, and I have this on the recordings. It's in my video, An Unknown Encounter, coming from above, because I had yelled up there for those guys to come down because, you know, you just felt like something was going to break, about to happen. And Gary had no part in this because he was over, you know, atop. I could see him looming above the attic in the crawl space. And when he got back to Jeff, he took a couple pictures using the flash to see where Jeff was. And when he got back there to him, Jeff was hanging by the neck with an old clothesline cord wrapped 12 or 15 times around his neck, tied over a nail protruding from one of those trusses, you know, that supports the...
How'd that happen?
Well, we asked him because I have the actual footage of this as he comes down. And I didn't know what I was shooting. I asked him, you know, what had happened. I mean, obviously it became clear that something had happened to him because I saw the rope around his neck. He said he took one step, that he heard us yelling down below about the strange light. And he took one step, something hit him in the throat. He blacked out. And when he came to, he remembers Gary's camera flash hitting him in the face. And when he came to, he said he felt something pulling on his legs at that moment, like it was trying to strangle him, until Gary got a little bit closer, and then it released him. So whatever this entity was, it was trying to kill him, George.
How would you compare this house to the Amityville Horror House?
Well, I've read about Amityville. I saw the movie, of course. I know there's some controversy about that case because I know there's some stories that say that some of it was fabricated. But I believe that there is probably some truth to it, too.
Yeah. Well, we know the murders happened.
Yes, the murders.
We know that.
The Ronald DeFeo murders.
Yep.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. There is a very, very strong similarity in one of the phenomena that happened in San Pedro. In the Amityville house, according to the witnesses, they said that they saw blood coming out of walls.
And flies on windows and everything else.
Flies and windows. Well, we had a lot of that in San Pedro. We had a lot of dead flies and dead insects all over
the
place.
Okay.
Absolutely. But one night on August 28th, and this was just a few nights before the hanging incident, there was this kind of a viscous liquid, pale yellow, kind of orangish substance that started oozing out of the wall cabinets. And I have it on video, so, I mean, it's on the videotape as it happened. And it was about 4 a.m. And when Taft took it to a lab near UCLA, one guy did a little moonlighting for us and got a lab analysis of it. It was, it was actually human blood plasma. with a heavy copper and iodine content.
Oh, geez.
Really weird, because, you know, plasma is made up of, like, water, proteins, and organic ions and so forth. And it's, I know in real plasma, it contains clotting agents, and, you know, quantum exposure air will form a clot. It's a protective thing within our blood.
What's going on there now, Barry?
Well, now, I haven't been back, actually, I should confess.
I don't blame you.
For a couple of years. I went down there after my book came out, and I talked to the landlord. Believe it or not, people still live in the house. He's still renting the house out. I don't think he tells them that it's haunted.
You have to. Don't you have to disclose that stuff?
It's supposed to be a law now that there's a disclosure.
In some states.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, I can't blame him, I guess. I mean, he's afraid to not get the rent money, but at the same time, he may be endangering a few people down there. But
give me rent money. By the way, your place is haunted. People have died there. You're going to see apparitions show up at night. No big deal.
Exactly.
Give me my check.
Exactly. And we know, there's a theory that there, you know, with the poltergeist agent theory, says that living human agents can generate psychokinetic phenomena. Well, you know, one of the theories is that Jackie's own mind has created this. I don't subscribe to that whatsoever, because when we later did an analysis of the cord wrapped around Jeff's neck, it was a bowline knot. That's a seaman's knot. And, of course, we were in a house that had been lived in by a lot of seamen. And, you know, also there in 2004, I was called down by the newspaper. They wanted to interview me about the house. And it was a family, the Luna family, Rosario Luna.
Their last name is Tick.
Yes. They moved out of the house because they were hearing strange noises. They were being touched by invisible fingers and things by the laundry room where all this started. But they never really went into the attic. They were hearing noises come out of the attic. And one morning, they woke up and all of their crockery, you know, dishes stacked in piles on the floor in the kitchen, real neat piles and utensils stacked up. And they left the house, and that's in my book, because I can imagine if it was just Jackie's mind, why is the phenomenon still going on 15 years after she moved out?
Absolutely. The name of the book, by the way, is called An Unknown Encounter, A True Account of the San Pedro Haunting. Are you glad you got out of there with your neck?
Yes, but, you know, it was lucky that for Jeff especially, because this thing had a real penchant for attacking him. And he moved up, Jackie moved up to a place called Weldon. She temporarily had a reconciliation with her ex-husband, and he got her up to a little trailer home up in the middle of nowhere on a dirt road called Chucker Street. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's up by the High Sierras. It's a beautiful country up there. And 5 months later down the road, this had been in the spring of 1990, I get a call from Jackie that this entity had followed her up there, much like the entity case with that the Barbara Hershey movie was based on.
Right.
And I remember, George, one of the things that was really weird was that when Jackie called me one day, there were all these dogs. She said there must have been like dozens of dogs that had surrounded the house, and they were howling. You could just hear this incessant howling, you know, coming through the phone line. It was scary. But, you know, I think at the time, though, even though I heard that, I was a little bit skeptical that the entity had followed her. I was pretty new to all of this kind of thing at that time. But believe it or not, well, of course you can believe it, Jeff never went back to the original house in San Pedro, which, where the thing had hung him. Thankfully, Gary had pulled him down. And he was rescued. But he was so curious, and he had a very good spirit about all of this. He actually went up there, back up there, 5 months down the road to Weldon, not thinking that anything would happen up there, because we wanted to probably follow the case all the way through and find out what was going on. And really what made it intriguing was that two other neighbors, a husband and wife, Jim and Janice Silcott, they were moving a big widescreen television set that someone had donated to Jackie, and it was not plugged in. And when they were moving it, and this is in the middle of the daytime,
uh-huh,
they were moving into the storage shed behind the house.
Don't tell me it went on.
Nope, but the old man appeared. The old man apparition appeared in that set, unplugged.
He showed up on the TV?
Absolutely, and Jim said he had very evil Charlie Manson-looking eyes.
That is weird. Hey, stay with us, Barry. We're going to take phone calls next. I want people to share their incredible ghost stories, not just average ones, incredible ones.